Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's teleseminar called How to Turn Your Workforce into Your Sales Force. My name is Damien Sen, and it's a great pleasure to have you on this PeopleYouShouldMeet.com teleseminar this evening. In a few moments from now, I'll be introducing our very special guest, Richard Parks Corder. But before I do that, I just wanted to share how this teleseminar will work this evening. Now, this call will run for around about an hour, and over the course of the hour, I'll be asking Richard a whole variety of different questions on the entrepreneurial process or motivating your workforce to actually bring in sales and really become your best salespeople. Now, I've known Richard for probably around 4 years ago. I think we first met, and it was on an entrepreneurial seminar, and we've sort of kept in touch over the years, and I guess my first professional contact with Richard was to actually listen to his Millionaire MBA program. Now, I've personally studied a whole variety of different programs on entrepreneurship, and at the time, it was certainly one of the best programs that I'd been exposed to. And since then, Richard's gone on to do a whole host of different things, including writing a couple of best-selling books, one called Millionaire Upgrade and the other one Business Upgrade. And he's just finished writing his new book called Turn Your Workforce into Your Sales Force. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the call Richard Parks Corder. How are you doing there, Richard?
I am very well. Thank you very much for a very generous introduction.
Welcome to the call. Now, Thank Richard, you. I was just wondering if you could actually kick us off this evening by just sharing how you became interested in the whole field of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, well, it goes back to probably the year before I met you. And I'd created a program called Millionaire MBA. And the reason I created that program is because I wanted to become an entrepreneur myself. And I'm sure, like many people, you've read a book called Think and Grow Rich, which is, for many other people, is a starting place if you want to become an entrepreneur. That's one of the key books you read. And in that book, there is, written by Napoleon Hill, written in 1937, he talks about a secret which he'll never reveal. This is the secret of success in business, in life, in your career. And I read that book many times looking for the secret. And he said it will reveal itself when the time is right. And I guess it never really revealed itself in the first couple of readings. But I was lucky enough, I'd actually just been fired, so that's why I was lucky to have that decision made for me to move out of the corporate world and had to go it alone by myself. I had a little bit of money behind me, and I decided that I could actually go out and interview entrepreneurs and find out from them, from the horse's mouth, what the secret of entrepreneurial business success is. And that led me to interview, at the time, about 30 of the UK's leading entrepreneurs, people that you probably heard of, or you certainly have, Duncan Bannatyne, Simon Woodruff, Sir Tom Hunter, Lord Billmoria of Cobra Beer, Lord Harris of Carpetright, Luke Johnson, chairman of Channel 4 now, really asking them all the same questions to try and uncover what it is that's going on in their mind that makes them so successful. And I asked about 29 different people, all the same questions, took their answers and recorded their answers digitally, chopped them up, and looked for the consistency in the language patterns, of which there was massive consistency. So it became very evident to me that there is a consistent entrepreneurial mindset. I formed my own opinion as to what is that secret that Napoleon Hill spoke about in Think and Grow Rich. And that became the essence of Millionaire MBA Business Mentoring Program. So that was my first step into all of this, in creating Millionaire MBA.
Well, I can certainly relate to getting fired. I actually made that a way of life for a number of years, moving from corporation to corporation and, strangely enough, getting fired. And you often hear lots of entrepreneurs talking about how they either got fired or some change of events literally propelled them into the entrepreneurial sphere. And I guess for you, Richard, personally, like, how have you actually found that journey? Has it been a rewarding one? What are some of the things that you've learned along the way?
Oh, it's been a joyous journey. I don't think, I often wonder what I would be doing now if I'd still worked in the corporate world. I used to work, originally, like you, I qualified as an accountant. but then I spent many years in the software consulting business. And I really don't know what I would be doing if I continued down that that route, principally because I didn't really enjoy what I was doing, and I didn't really believe in what I was doing. And when you look at what makes entrepreneurs successful, the heart of that is the passion, there's belief, and there's desire. They love what they're doing. They enjoy doing it. They believe in what they're doing. And so the results come to them. But if, you know, so many people in the corporate world, I was certainly one of those, if you don't have that, and this is part of the key to turning your workforce into your sales force, if you don't have people that are connected to the work they do at that very, you know, fundamental emotional level, you'll never get the results that you set out to achieve. So, you know, my journey, highs and lows. I call it euphoric highs and crushing lows. And but it's the only the belief in yourself and in your products and your services and what this is, the very thing that you're doing, the very goals that you set out to achieve, that keep you going through the crushing lows. The belief and the passion gives you the persistence to push forward. And, you know, again, that's such a consistent theme with entrepreneurs. It's the very inner, you know, belief in themselves and love of what they're doing that allows them to drive forward. And I've found it myself, you know, in my business as well.
Yeah. And of all the entrepreneurs that you've interviewed over the years, Richard, have you ever come across an entrepreneur that didn't actually experience the spectrum of experience from the highs to the lows? Has there anyone you've just met that has literally only just experienced highs on the entrepreneurial journey? Or is it just a natural part of being an entrepreneur that you'll experience the complete spectrum?
I've never met anybody that hasn't had the crushing lows as well. I think it's, you have to have them to give you the strength to move forward. And that's the kind of, there's a saying, one of the entrepreneurs I interviewed, Chris Gorman, he made about £45 million by the time he was, I guess, mid-30s, if not before. And it's a famous saying, the stronger the breeze, the stronger the trees. It's not revolutionary in any way, but it's very true. You know, you need, when you have those tough times, they test you, and they test your resolve. And if your resolve is there, and your belief and confidence is there, and your passion for what you're doing, you push through, and you get through ultimately to where you want to go. And again, just to bring it back to the, you know, to workforce, to sales force, if it isn't in there, if it's not in the depths of the people on the front line of your company and don't have that passion and belief in what they're doing, when the tough times come, when the difficult customers come, when the difficult projects come, you know, that's the make or break. But when you get people who believe in what they're doing, then they find a way through that. And so really, I mean, what I'm speaking about these days and writing about in the new book was about was getting that business owner way of thinking, which I've sort of alluded to, getting it into employees within companies.
Right.
But I can fill you in the bits in between if that's helpful in any way.
What would be helpful actually is to go a little deeper into just defining it out for people on the call, what exactly you mean by transforming your workforce into your sales force. And sort of having that entrepreneur enthusiasm just filter through the organization.
I mean, ultimately, I think for many managing directors, business leaders, predominantly they see the sales function of the company, the responsibility of the direct sales team or the marketing team. I've seen that in the organizations I've worked in, and certainly in my days in the software world, I would go into many companies implementing business systems. And so you get very close to companies and you see them in all shapes and sizes. So with that thought in mind, that for most companies, it's the direct sales team and the marketing department that are responsible for growing the business. Certainly, that's true. You know, you can't deny that that's their function. But ultimately, it's the rest of the organization which is responsible for the delivery of the products and services, the innovation, the creativity, and taking the products further forward and creating that relationship and engagement with the customer. And the reason this is key is because marketing and direct sales invariably is about getting a customer. It's about a one-time, you know, transaction. It's getting that first thing, first sale. But the wise words of Peter Drucker, the purpose of a business is to get a customer and then to continue to market and sell to them. But a customer will only continue to buy from you. You'll only be able to leverage their or maximize their lifetime value of a customer, which is where the real value is in the full lifetime. If that customer has had an outstanding, excellent relationship with you, if you've continued to thrill and wow and dazzle them, unlike what we were doing, you know, in the software world that I used to work, which was to disappoint them and to leave them the expectation level is up here. I've got my hand above my head now, and the delivery down here by my waist. And this is, you know, what's in between is the big disappointment or the expectation gap, which is not closed. The reason that isn't closed is because, as a company, we weren't giving the delivery by everybody in the organization. So what I'm trying to say is that it's everybody in the company which is selling, is ultimately responsible for selling, ultimately responsible for making your customers believe in you so that they want to, one, buy from you in the first instance, and two, come back and buy time and time again so you can maximize their lifetime value. But then the third thing is, you know, if the customer really believes in you and they're getting such an extraordinary relationship with you, then they do your marketing for you. They become customer and brand evangelists and tell their friends and family and business associates, which in itself, you know, we all know this, that if someone makes a recommendation to you, a trusted friend, we take that recommendation, ultimately a little sales pitch, much stronger than if a paid salesperson was giving the same message, simply because we have the trust with a friend or business colleague.
I had a very interesting experience at a party a couple of weekends ago when I was introduced to a fellow, and he actually held me captivated for 2 hours demonstrating all the different features of the new iPhone. And like, I've never actually been in the presence of a sales pitch like it. And he wasn't someone who worked for Apple at all, but he was just an absolute raving, rabid fan of the new iPhone, and literally went, just couldn't help himself, was going into all the intricacies, all the design features, the innovations with the software, the look and feel. It was quite a presentation, and certainly after just being in his presence, like, I had that enthusiasm, and like, I literally wanted to leave the party and go down and get an iPhone straight away. But it is infectious when you're around customers that have had an experience that is so incredible that they literally can't help themselves and to go out and tell everyone about it.
Well, and that really gets to the heart of what, you know, this is all about, turning your workforce into your sales force. How that the chap you met at the weekend, he wouldn't feel like that if the employees in the company, in Apple, in this instance, weren't truly in love with technology and with design, with innovation, with music, and just everything that goes into an Apple iPhone or an iPod. I mean, Macs and Apple, I just think, are fantastic anyway. But if they didn't have the right people in the first instance who just loved what they were doing, if it didn't pour out of them into the products and services, into the hands and the mind and the heart of the customer, then that customer, you know, just it would just be another telephone. I've got one here in front of me. I certainly couldn't, you know, get you excited about my old Nokia. Not saying that Nokia is a bad phone, but there's something going on in Apple which really shows how it shows all this playing out in one company. But it has to go back to the fact that they got the right people in there in the first place who just love what they're doing. Ultimately, they've got people in there who are thinking like business owners and just want to keep going further and further and further because they know that they have, there's people out there like the chap you met. Well, one will buy the next, when the next iPhone comes out or the next whatever it is, they've already got that hungry crowd, those customers who want to buy because they love what they're doing. And two, so they'll buy again. That's the second thing. You know, people, when customers believe in what you're doing, they buy again and then tell their friends. So he's already bought the first time. He'll come back and buy again, you can be sure, because he's a Mac fan or an Apple fan.
The whole suite, he had the laptop, the PC, the iPhone, all interconnected, so it is just in terms of extending that experience.
And so, therefore, lifetime value, I mean, these are the things, lifetime value and word of mouth, that's really what this, you know, this latest book is about. How can you build your company so you can maximize the lifetime value of your customer and their word of mouth recommendations? And you can only ever do that from the people within the company, from within the organization. So I hope this is making sense.
totally.
But it's, you know, I will add, it's been an interesting journey for me from millionaire MBA interviewing entrepreneurs to seeing just that link from entrepreneurs into bringing that business owner thinking, which is inherent in all successful entrepreneurs, and getting it in the front line of employees in companies. And you relate that back to Apple, taking that business owner thinking, that entrepreneurial spirit, which is alive in Steve Jobs, and getting it into every member of the staff so that it's coming through into the customers. So we as customers know what to expect from Apple. You know, we have such high expectation from them. I mean, they continually impress us and over-deliver, even though we have high expectations for them.
I had another friend actually just saying on the theme of Apple, who there's a, for those who haven't been there, there's a fantastic Apple shop right in the heart of London on Regent Street. And this friend of mine had actually bought an Apple, and for whatever reason the hard drive may have actually gone down, or the battery broke down or whatever, and he took it into the Apple Center for a service, and he said he was absolutely blown away by the technician that he dealt with in the Apple shop, and he was just explaining his predicament, and the technician just asked him, you know, like, how long have you actually been without your Apple Mac? And he just explained that, like, it must have been 48 hours or so, and he said, like, the expression on the technician's face was one of absolute horror, like how did you actually survive for 48 hours without your Apple computer? But yeah, just like another really good example of just having that feeling spread through the organisation, and even just in that context, having your frontline staff really echoing the message of the leader.
It's true, and you know, as we're talking about IT, I've actually got an article from the newspaper just last week actually in front of me. DSGI, so that's the Dixons Group. The headline is Back to School for 20,000 DSG Staff. PC World, Dixons, I think Currys are in the group as well. But the new chief executive has come in, and he realizes that just the simple stuff, such as how to greet a customer, how to understand the needs of the customer, they're listed here, how to offer alternatives, how to explain the features and benefits of the product, how to close with the complete solution, i.e. the accessories, these basics are not being done by their staff. And so, as a result, DSG lost £192 million last year. I think I'm reading this right. But that's not the case at Apple, is it? What's going on? What is the difference between the Apple retail stores and the PC World retail stores? Apple are creating something within them, within their organization, inside out, starting from the inside, is coming out into the marketplace, out into the customers. So they have, I mean, it's a cliche phrase, raving fans. I'm one of them myself. Yet I know full well when I go into PC World, it's a woeful experience. no, the prices aren't marked up. You're looking around, you found the product, now where's the price? You ask somebody, I don't know. And, you know, it's chalk and cheese. It's chalk and cheese, and really, I suspect what the chief executive at DSG is wanting to get is a little bit of what's going on at Apple into his staff. But again, it comes back to, you've got to give the people in the company something to believe in, something to be proud of, which is exactly what Steve Jobs does. You know, he is that very person. He is the epitome of everything which is Apple, and it just spreads out with equal strength in many cases. You know, it's not getting diluted. You know, I suspect if you had drinks with Steve Jobs at the weekend and he was showing you the new iPhone, he would be just as enthusiastic as the chap who showed you, and vice versa. What an amazing thing. How truly, truly amazing.
Yeah.
Now, how you do that, that's the challenge.
Now, Richard, I'm aware that there's many people on the call who will be running their own small businesses. So we've mentioned, like, how the framework works in bigger organisations such as Apple, and I was just wondering, do these principles still apply to smaller businesses?
Without question. I mean, it is the same, and it's probably more demonstrable in a small business, because you're, you know, it's either the small business is one person and it is the business owner, or it's a smaller number of people, you know, 5 or 10 individuals. But I can give you a couple of examples of how this works in a small business, lifted straight from my book, in chapter 2, as it happens, or chapter 1. it's two stories that happened to me recently, and I kind of built the whole book around these two stories. And it's the difference between the barman and the barber. And so, you know, this is bringing it back to small business. It doesn't get much smaller than this. Around the corner from where we live in Bath is a very nice pub, which has been around since the 1700s. And the beer in there is fantastic, and I've been many times for drinks, and it's great. And on this particular Sunday, I like Sunday lunches. I don't know if you're a big fan of going out on a Sunday lunch, but but I am. So on this particular Sunday, we went round there, so my wife and two children, and the place was empty for food, actually, which might actually tell the same story. But nevertheless, you know, we got set up, ordered our food, got in the upstairs in the restaurant, children in the high chair, waiting for the food. It turned up, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was tasty. It really was very scrumptious. But the portions were very, very small. I mean, this was sort of the crux of, you know, my complaint. The food was tasty, but the portions were tiny. And so, you know, I finished it, and I was hungry. I went to tell the chef. Now, you talk about small business. There's a barman, there's a chef, and there's a guy washing up, so it doesn't get much smaller on that particular instance. The chef wasn't there. I think he popped out. But I said to the barman, the food was tasty, but the portions were too small. Could I have a few more potatoes, please? And, you know, to cut a long story short, he said no. He said that's the size of the portions that the chef has set, and so that's that. And after, it was a couple of minutes, pointless conversation, he just turned his back on me, walked away, and that was that for him. Now, how does that relate to everything that I'm talking about here? Will I go back and buy from that restaurant again? No. Will I recommend them? No. Will I tell other people not to go and eat there for their Sunday roasts on a Sunday? Most definitely. And will they lose out because the decisions and the actions by the person on the front line, i.e. the barman, were the wrong actions? They weren't putting the needs of the customer first. He wasn't thinking like a business owner saying, you know, if this was my business, what would I do? He just, that was it, washed his hands of it, went downstairs and, you know, probably carried on reading the newspaper. But doesn't understand sort of the trail that's been left behind him, which is the negative vibe that's going in the marketplace. And unfortunately for them, they're in chapter one of the book. I don't name the restaurant or the pub, but, you know, the point is that actions have consequences. And he could have chosen to say, of course, sir, you know what, I think the same, have some more potatoes, here's another slice of beef and some more carrots. And it wasn't just me. I must add that, you know, my wife, who's a relatively light eater, felt exactly the same, that the portions were light. So that's an instance of it, in a small business, making the wrong decisions. And I tell the story also of Paolo, the barber. And it's not that Paolo, the barber, does anything extraordinary. It's just that he is a business owner. So since I moved to Bath, I've been getting my hair cut at this barber's shop in town. And it's probably the ropiest looking barber shop in town, yet it's also the busiest. And so I get my hair cut with this chap who I call Paolo. I know they're all Sicilian, and I didn't really know his name, so I just called him Paolo in the book. But he doesn't own the shop. He just owns the chair, or he rents the chair at the end of the shop. And so he knows full well that his income is based not on just, you know, a one-off haircut. If I went once and got my haircut, that's £15. That's fine. He'd be happy with that. But really, he wants me to go back every month or every 6 weeks and spend another £15. So in the course of the year, you know, it's a couple of hundred pounds or so that I'm spending with him. And in the course of 5 years and 10 years, you know, it all adds up. And he wants me to recommend him to other people, as I have done. So would he, if I'd gone into his, sat down in the barber's chair and said, that's super, but, you know, I want you to cut a little bit more off here. He said, no, I've cut all the hair I'm going to cut. I mean, it's a ridiculous example, but the point, you know, it just shows how nonsense it was from the barman to say no, that you can't do that, and losing out on that lifetime value and those referrals. You know, it would just never happen with Paolo, because he knows that his business is built on repeat business, i.e. lifetime value, and recommendations, word of mouth. So it happens, you know, it's so important, whatever the size of the business, that whoever is not just customer-facing, but at all levels in the organization, people are thinking like business owners and understanding the consequences, making that link between the revenue that's coming through the door and the salary that's, you know, being paid to them. At the end of the month, there's a one-to-one relationship. No money coming in, no money going out to pay salaries, bonuses, dividends, whatever else.
I just wanted to add as well, like with the, I suppose the whole scenario of an adverse customer experience, I think it's taken on even more meaning these days due to the fact of the whole phenomena of blogging and just the dynamics of people actually being able to share these messages online. And it was, has that actually formed part of your experience as well in terms of companies getting adverse feedback through blogging and then potentially having to respond to that?
Without question. And I have a chapter about that in the book, because I think it's so important to understand. I mean, you look on Amazon. I mean, this is the, just opens the door to see what's going on. You put a book on Amazon, people immediately rate it, good or bad or somewhere in between. And because of the internet and Web 2.0 and blogging and so on and YouTube videos, the consumer, the customer, has the opportunity to tell the world how good or bad you are. And so just a couple examples on that. I'll give you the first one about what happened to me. So anyone that gets in my way, I kind of tend to writing about them at the moment. But there is, around the corner from where we live, there's some new developments, building some new houses. And so therefore, there's months of disturbance and dumper trucks coming up and down the road. And last summer, which was very hot and dry, you know, it didn't have any rain, and so all the dust that was coming from the dumper trucks was just sitting on the cars and on the houses, and the road just looked, I mean, it looked like Armageddon. It really was a mess. And so the cars were just covered in this silt. And I rang up the construction company, who have their big billboard around the corner. They have their vans parked by, so it's very clear who they are. And rang to complain to the managing director, and you know, really what I wanted to do was to come and wash the cars, do something about the road, and wash the windows in the house. I mean, it was his mess that was causing this chaos down our road. And so I rang him, and I probably rang twice, getting them, asking them to call back. Not a word of response. And so, you know, to pick up on your message about blogging and so on, I took some photos. I mean, in fact, I wrote his name in the window screen of one of the cars. I wrote the company name in the windscreen of another car, and I took a photo of those two things. So it's got his, and his name represents the company, so you can't deny it's him. I took a photo of the van with the telephone number and a photo of the street, blogged it up on blogger.com. It took me 10 minutes to do all this.
Yeah.
And I said, XYZ company doesn't care for local residents, and then emailed it to his company. And within 2 hours, probably quicker actually, he rang back, very apologetic, and he said, okay, you know, you made your point. And, you know, it actually still remains up there on the internet, because he, although I made my point, he didn't send anyone around to do anything about it, and so I haven't taken it down. So, you know, how easy was that to do? It's ridiculously easy, but it would never have happened if the people in the company, I mean, he's a business owner himself, not thinking like a true business owner, but if the people in the company were a little more understanding about their environment, about their customers, you know, the whole thing that's going on there, if they put themselves in the shoes of the customer or the, you know, the people they were disturbing, they would say this is not good enough, and therefore it's damaging their brand. If I so desired, I could get that thing up on the search engines. I could get it to in the top three, and so when anybody searches for this company, you know, there it pops up. XYZ doesn't care for local residents.
Yeah.
But there's another example, if we've got time for it, just from the...
Yeah, sure.
Of Dell. I mean, this is now a big business. Of a guy, his name is Jeff Jarvis, and he's a journalist. And he had just, it happens sometimes, you get a bad computer. And if that happens, you get in touch, you send it back, and you get it resolved. But he just found himself in this Dell hell, going around with emails and telephone calls and them washing their hands of him. And he wrote a blog about it. And that, because he was a journalist, I guess he was able to get some exposure. And the thing caught fire. And he was getting thousands of responses and people joining force to join him, to put some pressure on Dell. And ultimately, it led to Dell making a massive investment in training. I mean, Dell's customer support is notoriously poor, or has been. But just a little bit of people power there. And that is just the power of the internet. It wouldn't have been very easy to do pre-internet, put it that way. It's not saying it's impossible, but certainly it becomes ridiculously easy with the internet to, as a customer, to have a voice and to create some momentum behind you and to put some pressure on the company. The key for the company is just to do the right thing in the first place and to give customers no reason to be disappointed. And if they have a problem computer, or if their road is looking like Armageddon, you fix it immediately and you overfix it and surprise them and wow them and say, gosh, that was brilliant. Mm. And turn a problem into an opportunity.
Mm. That's a very, very good point. Now, Richard, we had a whole series of different questions that actually came in through the site when people were signing up for the call. And I've chosen out a few of them, and I'm just going to ask you what your thoughts were on them. Now, I've got a question from Katriana in France, and her question was, where is the best place to start, to start implementing this way of thinking within a business?
Well, I mean, it starts with the business owner or the senior leader in the company, or a leader, somebody with a will and desire to change, to make a decision to say, we're going to do something about this. We are going to train and develop our staff to think like business owners. And just a zero-cost way of doing this is a question of training and education and teaching people to just turn it round and see things differently. But a very quick way of doing this is just four questions. And these four questions, get everybody in the company to ask these four questions of themselves when they're facing a customer, when they have a business challenge of some description. The questions are this. Number one, what would I do if this was my business? So, you choose any example. We'll choose one of those. Which ones are we just, well, let's say the barman. If it was my business, I'd give him more potatoes and some more carrots and some more vegetables. So first question, anything that's difficult, what would I do if it was my business? You'd make the right decision for the customer. And so that leads on to the second question. If I was a customer of this business, what would I expect to be done? Put yourselves in the shoes of the customer. Go back to the pub and the barman. You would expect to be given a little bit more. First of all, you would expect to have decent-sized portions. And then secondly, if you do make a complaint, you expect it to be resolved. And then the other two questions are, given the decision I'm about to make, what will that do for my customer's desire to come back and buy from me? So, tap into the lifetime value and recommend me, tap into word of mouth. If you do the right thing, then customers will come back and buy again, and you can turn adversity into opportunity, and they'll also recommend their friend to their friends. Conversely, if you do the wrong thing, they'll tell their friends, but they'll tell them to stay away or to avoid you. So, for nothing, you could just it's about creating a culture and an energy and a vibe within a company, but it can start by just getting people to literally train their thinking to say, what would I do if this was my business, and what would I do if I was expected to be done if I was a customer of this business? So I think that's the starting point, but yeah. I'm sure you're going to mention the website where you can actually read the book online for free, or most of it. So shall I mention that now, and then it's done?
You can mention it now, and we'll certainly mention it at the end of the call as well.
Oh, okay. Well, it's www.workforce2salesforce.com. And, you know, I made the decision to put the book on there free. It's a blog as well, so, you know, as thoughts and ideas come, I've been blogging those up. And it's just a place to capture the whole essence of what it is to train your workforce to become your sales force. So some of those examples I've spoken about already, you can read online.
Excellent. I certainly love that whole concept of turning problems into opportunities. And I think some of my best customer experiences have actually fallen out of situations that weren't that favorable for a business, and then they took steps to address it, and then literally, as a result of it, just had a phenomenal customer experience.
And in those moments, you can actually create lifetime customers. You can create evangelical customers because you have an opportunity to demonstrate how you can go beyond the ordinary. You know, just you, when the problems arise, and they do for everybody in every company, yeah, it is a real opportunity to turn it round and over-deliver. That's the time to actually go beyond the call of duty. Mm. And so the customer goes, the problem was there was never a problem. It becomes irrelevant. Mm. But what they speak about is what they did to fix it.
Mm. Great. Okay, cool. I've got a question from Simon in the UK. And Simon asks, how do you get employees, particularly account managers, who just think of themselves as administrators, to think this way about selling?
Well, it's, you know, those four questions I spoke about before, getting people to introduce that into their way of thinking is important because, I mean, really when I talk about turning a workforce into Salesforce, it isn't necessarily direct selling. It's actually creating an environment by de facto the workforce becomes a sales force because everybody's just performing at a higher level. So, sorry, can you just repeat the question?
So how do you get employees, particularly account managers, who just think of themselves as administrators, into thinking about this way of selling?
It is an education. It's a training process. And it's, you know, it doesn't happen overnight, doesn't happen like that, which for me, you know, I provide a program, a training program behind all of this, which slowly but surely trains and readjusts the way people think so they start to think like business owners and therefore start to make the right decisions and therefore influence or, you know, connect with the customer. So they immediately, you know, the customer connects and the sale happens. But it is... there's no quick fix other than training and developing and creating a culture and having people in the top of the organization who believe in it and want to create, you know, create an environment where this happens. Now, how does Steve Jobs fix it? Did he fix Apple overnight when he came back? He didn't, but slowly but surely, you know, he just created the culture and the environment where it happens, where the sparks start to come alive. So I'm afraid I haven't got a quick answer to it other than, you know, you got to make a decision and take action and start the training. And in many ways it's unlearning what was going before and relearning and repositioning your thoughts for the future.
Cool.
You could start by reading the book. You can read it online.
Cool. Okay, we've got a question from Brian in Australia, and Brian wanted to know how he could successfully upsell.
How to successfully upsell? Well, probably going a little bit off topic because, you know, this isn't necessarily a book about upselling and downselling. Other than it is when you talk about lifetime value of a customer. And I think the thing about upselling is, why would you buy again from a supplier, from a company? You would buy again if the first transaction that you had was a fantastic one. You know, if you gave them reasons in the first instance to believe in you and want to buy more from you and you created the right environment, then the upselling becomes much, much easier. But if you, you know, if it was all about just getting the sale, getting the one-off sale, you know, would you want to go back and buy again? You really wouldn't. I talk about this this thing called the inverted pyramid, and I'm sure you're familiar with Nordstrom in America.
Yeah.
Been around, a retail company, been around since 1901. And they, you know, it's their idea, or you know, they borrowed it from somewhere else, but they talk about it in their books and on their website. And it's just the inverted pyramid, where traditionally in most companies, when you draw out the organization structure, you have the leader at the top. If you're thinking now of an organization chart, leader at the top, underneath that is the team, and underneath that, by definition, is the customer. So the customer is almost at the bottom in the perception of the organization. What Nordstrom do, and I think what all great companies do, is to flip that round and make sure the customer is always at the top. And, you know, everybody's there to serve the customer. So these people in the, you know, the account managers, I think you could call them, it's about just realizing that the very purpose of the company is to serve the customer. And that is your job, it's your responsibility. It's about putting the needs of your customers first, ahead and above your own needs. If you haven't got a customer, it's very, very simple, you haven't got a business. You haven't got the cash coming in, you're out of cash, you're out of the game. So, but in so many organizations, that is, I mean, we all see it because we go to shops and we're stood there waiting whilst, you know, the shop assistant is talking, or you make an inquiry and they don't come back to you, or you, I mean, there's just so many examples of where it's not working because the pyramid is the wrong way around. But create the culture where everybody understands that this whole thing is about the customer, is about serving the customer. And, I mean, it's just a phenomenal way. That's how the greatest companies perform. It's all about the customer. And it shows from all the way down, you know, from the guy who's delivering the service or the girl to someone who's, you know, you take Apple again. You know, the packaging is just phenomenal in Apple. You talked about what's happening in the shops. You talked about the customers, how they rave about it. I'm sure you go through all the layers, wherever you peek and pull back the curtain in Apple, it's the same sort of thing because they're doing it because they love it and it's for the customer. And then it becomes, you know, iTunes came from nowhere to just be ubiquitous because customers love it, because they've created something there for the customers to get hold of and believe in.
Mm.
I hope that's making sense.
Okay, excellent. Now, I've got a question from Claire in the United Kingdom, and Claire just said that she loved your Millionaire Upgrade book, and that her question was, like, how do you actually pick the right people to support your vision?
Yeah, I mean, it is a key part of it, chapter 8 or 9, I think, recruitment and training, and it's... I mean, the success of any company is its people. You get the right people in the company, you've got a very good chance of the company performing. You get the wrong people, you know, you're dead in the water, as good as. And it's, in my opinion, it is actually knowing what you're looking for and recruiting people, not just on their skills, but on their attitude. And so much of CVs are about skills. You know, we mentioned before that you were an accountant, I was an accountant, but I think we were the worst accountants in the world, or we were right up there of the worst. You know, yet I'm sure we could both put together decent CVs that suggest that we half know what we're doing in the world of accountancy. But the CVs lie, you know, but personality, attitude doesn't. It's a bit like if you ever watch football managers, when they're interviewed after or before matches, they don't talk about the skills of passing a ball. They talk about character, about attitude, about persistence and determination. And you know, it's the character traits. And so really, in my opinion, it's about looking, of course you've got to have people with the right skills or trainable to have the right skills, but it's marrying that personality to the business. And so it makes recruitment a much more important and a much harder task. It's very easy to recruit the wrong person. There's a lot of pressure from all places to get somebody on board. But, you know, it's an expensive thing if you have the wrong person because one, you know, that maybe not good at their job or not connected to their job, so they're not performing. You may have to get rid of them. You may have to re-recruit. The whole thing, you know, falls down if you get the wrong person. But getting the right person who's got the right personality, the right attitude, who shares the passion that you share, who understands the inverted pyramid, you're doing it for the customer. I mean, that's what you've got to be looking for. And then once you get the right person on board, then it's a question of continually training and developing and giving them the opportunity to grow and to develop their own, you know, that sort of the business owner way of thinking. You basically want to be recruiting people who think or understand that they need to think like business owners, because that's how you grow the business. If you recruit people who are just skills, they've got the wrong mindset, you know, it just doesn't come out in the products and the services, and it doesn't come through to the customers. And you would never have had that conversation, you know, if Apple had got the wrong people in there with that guy at the party at the weekend who was just raving about the product. You know, that came as a result of getting the right people in the first place who were passionate about what they were doing and good at what they're doing, don't get me wrong. But you can have, I mean, I think with that example of the accountants is just perfect, because, you know, you can have an accountant who loves what they're doing, loves the numbers, all got the same piece of paper. We all have letters after our name. Yet the one who can just demonstrate the love of what they're doing will be a far better accountant. We've ended up going in the same direction in many ways because, you know, we obviously got it wrong when we set out on that path as accountants.
That was always my downfall, just trying to demonstrate my love and joy of accounting.
Good luck.
Okay, well, this is a question from Leora in the United Kingdom. And Leora asks, how can I get different facilitators and teams to be motivated to make sales? I'm a workshop facilitator and I work with two other facilitators who get paid per event. Therefore, subsequent workshop sales are not in their direct interest.
Well, if I've understood the question correctly, it's how do you motivate someone that has a different agenda or doesn't necessarily want to be motivated? And, you know, for some years now, I've been looking at human psychology and performance, and part of that is motivation. And I've yet to find out how to motivate someone who doesn't want to be motivated. You can inspire people, you know, in the short term, but there isn't a great answer to that, because you either have the wrong people there, or you've got something wrong in the business. It could be the reward system. You know, maybe there's an opportunity to change the reward system. But really, you know, it goes back to inverting the pyramid again. And it goes back to getting the right people. Doing it because they love it, that want to serve the customer. So want to get these people, these customers, coming through to future seminars, was it, or events. But I don't have an answer how you motivate someone who doesn't want to be motivated. Creates it an obstacle. You can try forever and a day, but it's not going to happen. But if you get the right people and you create the right environment and give them something to believe in and that they're passionate about, and that that equitably is rewarded equitably, then you're giving yourself the best chance. But I see the problem that's there. I mean, you always go back to the question, if you were the business owner, what would you do? And so that's the question back to Leona. If it was your business, or of the other two people that are creating the problem, if it was your business, what would you expect to be done? And if you're a customer of that business, what would you expect to be done? You'll find the right answer in there, but thinking there's some clever trick to motivate someone who doesn't want to be motivated, you know, if you find it, let me know.
Yeah. And you must have been exposed to lots of different forms of remuneration, from bonuses for good performance or recognition for staff. What ones have you seen to be most effective in really successful entrepreneurial companies?
I mean, it's true that money plays a part in motivation. So you there's no doubt about that. But So that's all of those forms, whether that is dividend or bonus or share option. It all plays a part, but it isn't just about money. That isn't really what creates the perfect successful company. And to give you, you know, the obvious example around that, we'll go back to our friend Steve Jobs. Do you think that guy's motivated by money? You know, he's got all the money in the world you could ever wish for. Bill Gates has. They're not doing it for the money. They're doing it because for the purpose, for the love of it. And if you can create an environment in your company which is the same, where everybody else is doing it for the love of it and for serving the customer, then the money can come. But if you make money the primary objective, therefore it's secondary to the customer. And it can only ever be, the success of a company can only ever come from its customer. So, you know, it's my view on this, and it's from looking at a lot of successful entrepreneurs and a lot of successful business leaders and companies, is that it is the balance between monetary reward, but more so creating an environment that people, you know, giving them something to believe in. And Howard Schultz, the founder of Starbucks, has a good line on this, if I can remember what it is. I mean, it's basically along the lines of you've got to give people something higher, a higher purpose to believe in. And I think Starbucks have been a little guilty of letting that slip in recent years, and probably so because Howard Schultz had stepped out of the company. But there certainly was a time where, you know, Starbucks was the premier coffee and you believe in it and you just love it. And I'll give you an example of where you can see it actually playing out today is Innocent Drinks, the smoothie company. I mean, that is a company that they've gone from zero to 100 or 150 million quid in 5 years. I mean, absolutely flying. But I just, you know, I'm confident that everybody in that company knows what that company stands for. The money's coming to them, clearly, but, you know, they just want to create the best smoothies out there in the world. You know, just it's just evident what's going on there. They're just so quirky, interesting. The food, the product is wonderful. The packaging, the story is great, and so it creates a life and an energy of its own. Whereas I met with a client recently, and so I won't say who they are, but to give you an example, where innocent drinks, I think everybody knows what it is they're selling. They believe in it. It's just, you know, it's within them. And you asked, if you could ask anybody at that party who worked for Innocent Drinks, what was it that makes your smoothies better than the competitor, they'd be able to give you the same passionate response as that customer using the iPhone. Whereas the client I met with recently, let's say they sold soap, and I met with one of the guys or the employees who was going through one of my programs, and one of the early questions in that program is very simple: who is your customer? What is your product? Why would they buy your product over and above your competitors? And he'd worked at this company for more than 10 years. And, you know, he couldn't say why his soap was better than the next bar of soap. He said, I don't come into contact with the soap. I don't use that brand of soap. I don't see it in my day-to-day, my day-to-day job. Therefore, you know, he's not alive. He's not engaged. He's got nothing to be proud of, and then nothing to get anybody excited about. You could pay him more and more money, but you're feeding the wrong thing. You need to be creating an environment that people are proud of, that love what they're doing, and then that will come out in the soap itself. It's a bit of a silly example, but it shines in the product, and then the customers pick up on it. And you sell more, you get more lifetime value, you get more word of mouth, you get more cash coming through the business, and therefore you get more bonus or more whatever it is, the monetary reward. But you can't have the monetary reward without having the outstanding product in the first place. And so really the focus has to be on motivating people behind what the company is and getting everybody to understand that. And consequently then, that's where the money comes. As a result of that.
Excellent. Now, Richard, we're actually coming up to the end of the hour, and I'm sure there are people on the call who would actually like to deepen their knowledge in this area, and I was just wondering if you could share with them how they could find out more information about what your company offers.
Well, the best place to do this, to start, is to go to workforce2salesforce.com. And there, well, I mentioned already that I keep a blog there, so I've started writing about this recently. The book is available. Most of the chapters are available there to read online at no charge. The appendices, where there's some sort of real practical how-to, they're protected, but that kind of steers you to buy either the paperback or the ebook version of the core of the book. But that is, I think that's the best place, is to go there, is to register, to sign up to the blog. You can get a replay of this phone call on there, and you can also access, when you sign up, some of the interviews I did with the entrepreneurs. So I put together a 25 or 30 minute just snapshot where you'll hear what I'm saying true, because you'll hear, well, it becomes true because you'll hear it coming from the words and the voices of the entrepreneurs I interviewed. And you'll hear, therefore, business owner thinking in its purest, and you'll read through the book and the blog and the website how to start to bring that into your organization. So workforce2salesforce2.com is the starting place.
Terrific. And so you mentioned your programs as well. If people want to, I guess once they've read the book and they've inspired by the concept, how do they actually participate in your programs?
Well, the programs, so the book really is the introduction to the subject of business owner thinking, the subject of turning your workforce into your sales force. And in many ways, if you, in the book alone, you know, I wanted to make the book stand alone so you could actually do it yourself. And so I put as much content in there as I practically can to give you the tools to do it yourself. But I know full well that not everybody will take on that challenge. It's taken me over 2 years to create the program, so I know that there is an easier route out there for most people, which is to read the book and then to come back to me. But the Enterprise Leader Program, in its in summary, is an 8-week personal and professional development program for key employees and frontline managers. And the way it's delivered is through MP3 players. And this was the success of Millionaire MBA, by putting the whole thing on an MP3 player where people listen to the program 15 to 30 minutes a day, every day over a long period, or a period of 8 weeks. And so I just replicated that for the Enterprise Leader Development Program. But there's an introduction to that in the book, and that's, you know, the starting point is to read How to Train Your Workforce to Become Your Sales Force.
Okay, brilliant. Right, we're literally, we're coming up very close to the hour, Rich, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for sharing your wisdom and expertise over the last hour. And certainly from my own personal point of view, I just wanted to thank you for the programs that you have created over the years, because they certainly have provided tremendous value for me in terms of growing my own thinking as an entrepreneur and really, I suppose, taking steps along that entrepreneurial path. And, I get just in closing, Richard, I was just wondering, is there like a final piece of advice you'd like to offer to would-be entrepreneurs out there looking to embrace this kind of thinking?
Well, it's not just to would-be entrepreneurs. I'd like to, for business owners, business leaders of all shapes and sizes, whether you're the company is yourself, or whether you're running a multinational with hundreds of thousands of employees, I suppose the message is the same. And you just have to think back to all of those big multinationals which are there today. So you go back to Ford, to IBM, to McDonald's, to Nike, to any big name that you want. They were all started by an entrepreneur who had that passion and that desire. And there was just something about them. And that's what drove them forward and made them become successful. I spoke about DSG, Dixon's, a moment ago. That was started by a man called Sir Stanley Carms. And it's interesting now that he's left the organization not so long ago, you know, in recent years. And now it's, you know, back to school for the 20,000 DSG staff, ultimately trying to learn, reconnect with the way of thinking that Stanley Karms had. It's that entrepreneurial thinking that's there in employee number one that you need to keep as strong in employee number 200,000 if you're McDonald's or you're IBM or you're somebody, or you're probably million plus now. The need is to keep business owner thinking in the front line, get every employee in the organization to think and act and make decisions as if they were the owner of the business and not just an employee in the business. That's how you, in my opinion, grow businesses, make them strong, make them successful, make customers love them and want to buy from them, buy again, and then do their marketing for them.
Excellent. Cool. Thanks very much, Richard. For those on the call, if you would like to listen to this recording again, it will be made available certainly through Richard's website, Workforce to Salesforce, and that is workforce to the number two in the middle, salesforce.com. And it will also be available for download through the peopleyoushouldmeet.com website on the recordings page. Thanks, Richard, for your wisdom and expertise this evening.
Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone who submitted their questions, and we all look forward to having you on a peopleyoushouldmeet.com teleseminar very soon. Okay, take care. Thanks, Richard.
Cheerio.